American law, taught it for 25 years, and I really didn't expect anything more than what happened from the point when he failed to indict to how he set up the grand jury process. There's a saying in the United States that a prosecutor can get a ham sandwich indicted if they want to. And so it's all about how you set up the process, and clearly he set up a process in order not to get an indictment, and then he defended that. He acted as a defense attorney in explaining that lack of an indictment.
So, in effect, the fix was in?
Yes.
So, what is your sense then of how, are there, in your experience as a professor of law, is there any examples where the police actually have been held to account?
The truth of the matter, in recent history, in the last 20, 30 years, there has been a significant change in how the law deals with police and police misconduct. And there has been one case where there was an indictment, and then the judge threw that out. Police almost never, even go past their department discipline. When they go before a grand juries almost never indict them, and that's largely because prosecutors and police work together. And if the prosecutor doesn't protect the police, we have elected prosecutors, and in our society, prosecutors get elected by being tough on crime. They need police cooperation in order to be able to do that. And so prosecutors have an incentive to back police plays.
Well, in the prosecutor McCulloch's presentation, towards the end in particular, after he'd blamed the press and social media, in effect blamed Michael Brown, he did kept talking about how we have to make sure that this never happens again. And to me, this was the central contradiction into everything that he was saying. On the one hand, he's saying this should never happen again, but his whole presentation was suggested that nothing really did happen, that nothing unlawful happened, that there was no case.
What was he saying?
Yeah, that
I was questioning what was he saying should never happen again.
Exactly.
That a young black man who is unarmed is killed, or that he has to go through the process of putting on this grand jury process when he doesn't want to have to do a grand jury process. Often, like for instance, so many of the police cases don't even go that far. And so, the question is, what is he talking about never happening again? But I think those were throwaway words to try to make people feel like, okay, something more is going to be done.
So,
and it just wasn't.
So, but is that to say that there will be some justice delayed, but justice nevertheless in terms of civil suits and the Justice Department, civil rights suits, et cetera?
I don't think the Justice Department is going to step into this because the problem is that the Justice Department could have stepped into the issue decades ago. The killing of young black men, unarmed black men, is nothing new. And the Justice Department has not really stepped in to force police departments to be accountable. So I doubt that they're going to step in on the Mike Brown case. As for the problem with civil suits is that, and I suppose if you're talking about justice for the Brown family, there is some potential relief from the Brown family in a civil suit. It's potential, there'll be some potential relief in a civil suit. And oftentimes, cities settle these. So they settle with the families and end up giving a large amount of money. I keep saying that the amount of money that cities pay out to protect cops' bad behavior is enormous. But the bigger issue is that doesn't at all address, even if that happens, even if they won a case at civil suit, that will do nothing to change the behavior of police around the country. We just had a 12-year-old boy killed up in Cleveland, Ohio, with a fake gun. In a park just 2 days ago, 2 or 3 days ago. Here in my own city, we have in a suburb of our city, a young man who picked up a BB gun or toy gun in a Walmart was shot and killed by police. More black men and women, and I need to say women because people forget the women who are being killed, more black men and women, on average, are being killed each year by police. Unarmed men and women are being killed by police than were killed on average from lynching during Jim Crow.
Now, you just mentioned bad police behavior and how this is obviously the lack of an indictment in the killing of Michael Brown, the unarmed teenager who was shot 6 times. This verdict, the lack of an indictment, is clearly not going to help improve police practices in Ferguson. And that, to me, was the whole missing element. And after all of the long presentation and the prosecutor talking about how many hours they'd worked and how diligent they were and how much evidence they'd sifted through and complaining about how eyewitness accounts differ as if that was a revelation. He never really described what really happened there. And my interpretation of what happened, just trying to read through the lines, is that the scuffle in the car where Michael Brown was shot in the thumb, where 2 bullets were discharged by the officer while he was still in his car, indicated that there was a serious scuffle. And my sense is that this policeman simply just was enraged. And he was in a white-hot rage pursuing this kid who apparently, you know, turned around and allegedly charged him. I have never heard of anybody charging somebody that's shooting 10 shots at you. Have you ever heard of anybody doing that?
No, and I think, you know, this is the problem with the system is set up. First of all of that is a defense. So, which is why I say the grand jury was set up. That would be a defense to a charge, not whether or not he ought to be charged. The question becomes, which is clearer, is whether his behavior taken in light, because this is what you're supposed to do, in light of the victim's viewpoint, whether there's enough evidence for an indictment.
That's the job that he should have done.
That's it. That's all you're supposed to look at.
Right, right. And he more or less did the opposite.
That's right. And then the question becomes, at trial, the officer gets to put on, well, but this is what happened from my point of view. And then the jury gets to make a decision. I felt like what they did in the grand jury is turn the grand jury into a trial by presenting all of this evidence. This is way more evidence than you normally present to a grand jury, because you're normally not trying to show both sides of the story. You're just trying to show the side where you want the conviction. The indictment.
Sure. So this, I take it, Vernelia Randall, takes us back to the very questions that were raised in the beginning when this prosecutor was appointed, that there were calls for a special prosecutor because this prosecutor, his father was a policeman who was shot by an African-American in the line of duty, and there was an expectation.
And he's had a long history of being really tough on black defendants. It's not just that his father was shot. It's that he has a history that shows that that has affected how he can view, how he views black defendants, his own history of prosecution.
Well,
but the governor didn't decide to step in. But then the governor has a history as well of being a very conservative, very law and order kind of person. And so the he's a Democrat, but he's a conservative Democrat. And so you have the problem where the governor didn't step in to do anything as well.
Well, I find it extraordinary that there was, back in 2008, there was a whole sense in this country that the fact that Americans had elected their first African-American president was a sign of racial healing and progress. And yet, in many ways, the fact that this president has been so demonized and it's been open season on being able to hate him, as the Republicans do in the Congress. That's why we have broken government. It seems to be driven more by, the gridlock seems to be driven more by pure burning hatred than it does. It's reached a point of being irrational. So what's your sense then of how, do you think that in a way the election of Obama has sort of backfired? It's almost made racism acceptable. Or hatred,
well,
hatred acceptable.
Well, I think that's true. I think, as a person who felt that Obama did not bring a good history for addressing racial justice, I've been significantly disappointed in him, and even in terms of his reaction to the lack of indictment. I think what has happened, and this is not unusual, in anybody who understands race relations, I've been a first all my life. I'm 70 years old, and in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed when I was a young adult. And so every major job that I have, I've been the first. And one of the things that always happened to the first is backlash from the people in the environment who believe that you don't deserve it, that you shouldn't be here, that their racism come out. So the backlash to Obama was clearly predictable. I mean, it would have been surprising if it hadn't happened.
Right.
But the other problem is people didn't see this. Many people, especially whites, and saw the election of Obama as a sign of their colorblindness. Oh, look how colorblind I am. I voted for Obama. So that means our society has moved to a point now where we don't have race problems. And so what has happened since the election of Obama is that the whole discussion of racism has turned on their head, so that if you try to talk about race and racism in American society, people attack you because they believe you are going against the fact that we are a colorblind society now, and that the election of Obama proves that we are a colorblind society. I do believe that that as a black, the first black in as president, he is catching a lot of resistance and backlash to his presence. I think Obama has made that worse by trying to play it down instead of dealing with it head on and dealing with racial issues head on.
Well, it particularly ironic when in that presentation by the McCulloch, the prosecutor in Missouri, that he went, I don't know how many times he invoked the name of Eric Holder, as though that they were working hand in glove. Did you notice that?
Yes. And I think that they may, the Justice Department, they're working with the Justice. I mean, it's clearly they work to set up the release and the I understand that the Homeland Security might have been in the area, that this was that there was a coordination between the state and the Ferguson. I believe that that his invoking the name of Eric Holder is the typical sort of, if I say a black man is involved in this, then I can't be racist sort of thing. You know, sort mm-hmm. of like, I have a black friend, so if I have a black friend, I can't be racist. If I'm working with a black person, Eric Holder, then this can't be racist.
Well, Vanellia Randall, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Vanellia Randall, who is Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio. Her writings are at her website, racism.org, and she's the author of the book, Dying While Black.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
KBOO at the Clinton, a monthly film screening at the Clinton Street Theater, is proud to show Five Broken Cameras on Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. The first ever Palestinian film to be nominated for Best Documentary Feature, Five Broken Cameras is a deeply personal first-hand account of life and nonviolent resistance in a West Bank village surrounded by Israeli settlements. Shot by Palestinian farmer Ahmad Burnat, who brought his first camera in 2005 to record the birth of his youngest son, the film is structured in chapters around the destruction of each one of Bernat's cameras. Again, that's Five Broken Cameras, Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's about 9:57. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. At 11 o'clock this morning, we've got the Recovery Zone. Host Stephanie Potter speaks with professor and writer Mark Beekhoff about our need to reconnect with our natural landscapes and with animals, also about his book, Rewilding Our Hearts. But coming right up at 10, we're going to hear Flashpoints featuring American Indian Movement founder Bill Means speaking out against the racist use of Indian culture and names by professional sports teams. Also from the archives, an interview with a Native American who was roughed up and detained during a San Francisco Giants game on Native American Heritage Night. That's all coming up very soon. But in the meantime, we're going to listen to a little bit of music. And thanks for tuning in today. Isn't this pretty? It's music from Iraq. Okay, here comes Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, American Indian Movement founder Bill Means speaks out against the racist use of Indian culture and Indian names by Major League sports teams. Also from the archives, an interview with a Native American who was roughed up and detained during a Giants game on Indigenous Peoples Day. My name is Mike Biggs. All this coming up ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, California, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we turn our attention back to the indigenous movement's quest to finally, once and for all, put an end to racism in the context of professional sports and the use of racist names in terms of corporate sports teams. And two folks who have been on the front lines and have been busy all weekend are in the studio, in the Flashpoint Studio. We have Bill Means, a founder of the American Indian Movement on the International Treaty Council. And we've got Tony Gonzalez, who is the head of AIM West, the American Indian Movement West. You guys were busy yesterday. Welcome, Bill Means, and tell us what brings you here to the Bay Area from your beautiful Midwestern home, and what were you doing yesterday?
Well, first of all, good morning to you, and good afternoon,